Hello and welcome to DNA, Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. On today's show, a look at California Romantica, Birth of the Cool, and a colourful bowl of rice. But first, LA has jump-started auto show season with its earlier-than-ever annual show. This year, the theme, of course, is green. But more importantly, it's the other kind of green, as in what will actually sell to a public that mostly isn't ready to downsize their wheels. Dan Neal is the Pulitzer Prize-winning auto critic for the Los Angeles Times. You have come to our station hot off driving one of this year's supposed cutting-edge vehicles. Tell us about it. Are you still reverberating from the excitement?
Reverberating is the very word. Yes, I'm just tingling with the experience. It is the Honda FCX fuel cell vehicle. Now, a lot of companies have made fuel cell vehicles. Honda is the first company to really make what are legitimately called production vehicles. They will lease these vehicles to people in California and other markets where hydrogen is available for $600 a month. And these will be real live cars that people will drive for 3 years. And it looks like a spaceship. And it's an electric car with a hydrogen fuel cell energy source. And it's just a staggering engineering achievement.
What would you say is really the greenest of cars that you saw, the most viable greenest of the cars on show?
For our area, I would have to say something like a Mercedes E320 BlueTEC diesel, because it's a premium car, a luxury car. A lot of people buy them, and a lot of people buy them, you know, because they're stylish and fashionable, but they don't get very good gas mileage. This gives those people, affluent people, a chance to greatly improve their fuel economy, and they don't have to suffer. The same sort of tortured logic might apply to the Cadillac Escalade hybrid.
I was going to get onto that. What was the silliest car?
That has to be the silliest. It's difficult because you don't want to tell people, and you can't tell the American consumer, all of you have to drive Honda Insights or your pigs. You cannot revoke the compensations of capitalism. You have to give affluent people the cars they want and just make those cars more efficient. So in one sense, the Cadillac Escalade, which is kind of this emblematic of bling and excess, is a very poor choice to make a hybrid. And this is really where we are in terms of automobiles and the environment and society. We produce these kind of contradictions.
Which in your view, this is a design show, which in your view represented the best, I suppose, unity of technology and styling?
Oh, I would have to say the Honda FCX, which is this extravagantly streamlined shape. In car design, we have what's called the laydown. That is the angle of rake of the front windshield. This thing has a raked windshield like a 1970s Maserati Mirac, a very, very exotic car. And it's beautiful flowing lines, really appealing, and it's wrapped around all this extraordinary engineering. Volkswagen had a vehicle called the Up, which was basically, I mean, you know, you hear it said a lot, a box on wheels. Well, this was more like a box of cereal on wheels, very tall, upright on wheels. But the space efficiency was marvelous. And the reason it was possible is that the powertrain, the engine and the drivetrain and the wheels, all of those components have been shrunk so small. So now you have a very, very space efficient rectangle on wheels, and you can do a lot of things with them. That's really what's happening. As other mechanical components shrink, it expands the area that designers can use for the living space inside the vehicle.
So a car can get smaller but still feel spacious.
That's exactly right.
Why the Mini has been able to.
Speaking of which, do you like the Mini? Didn't you guys give away a Mini? I think you did.
We did, but next year we're giving away a smart car. So let's tell our listeners about the smart car. What's your view of that?
Well, first of all, it was my idea to give away the smart car. Somebody at the studio asked me, every year I get this call, you know, what should we give away? I suggested a smart car. And lo and behold, so let it be written, so let it be done. And the smart car was a project begun by Mercedes-Benz and Swatch in the early 90s. Just now, in the past year, they've decided to launch the American arm of smart. The car weighs about 900 kilograms, maybe a little less. It costs anywhere from 11 to 15 thousand if you really want the, you know, all the bells and whistles, which I believe in the smart car includes a bell and a whistle. And it's just incredibly cute and really fun. You can park it. You can literally park it perpendicular to the curb, which is a big advantage in Europe. Unfortunately, in the U.S., parking authorities don't know how to meter for that. So you're not – even in forward-thinking Santa Monica, you're not going to be able to park them perpendicular to the curb, alas. But they're great. They're fun. Here's the interesting thing. This car is designed, you know, well over a decade ago. In the intervening decade, car design's gotten a lot more fuel efficient. You could probably find bigger cars that get about the same fuel economy or maybe a little better. The other downside to the Smart is, and why you wouldn't want to drive it in, say, Arkansas, where there are a lot of big trucks, you know, you do give a lot away in Newtonian advantage in the unlikely event that you're in an accident. So keep it in the city where speeds are low. That's my opinion.
Dan Neal, thank you so much, as always.
Well, I hope that was helpful, Francis.
A byproduct of LA's car culture is street graphics that are at a size to attract drivers. So when Urban Partners built a mixed-use block over Wilshire and Vermont Subway, they commissioned a public artwork that grabs drivers, even though their building was an example of pedestrian-based smart growth. A 75-foot-high oil painting on two end walls that face Vermont and Wilshire is called Hand Holding a Bowl of Rice. It was created by the artist and designer April Griman and was painted by the muralists Rafael Valencia and Jim Farenstock. The image is of a brightly coloured, highly pixelated hand and rice bowl and celebrates the staple food of Asia for this Korean neighbourhood. It's a piece of work that is vintage April Griman, says Liz Farrelly, a design writer and editor. Her many books include April Griman, Graphic Evolutionary.
I think it's a fantastic intervention into an urban landscape. It's probably the biggest oil painting that you're ever going to see. And it just has that sort of ability to sort of to be different from wherever you're looking at it and to change as you approach it. So I think April's really considered how it works with the building and how it works with the vistas of the... And it's an incredible feat of skill by the two guys who made it under the supervision of April Griman and who painted it sort of nonstop for 29 days in oils. Because apparently, originally it was supposed to be sort of printed on a film and then stuck to the vendor, but there was a problem with that, so they started painting.
Tell us a little bit about April Griman and how this sort of fits in with her work.
Well, April was one of the first people to explore the use of new technologies, of computer technologies in image making and graphic design. And her approach to design is very image-led. It's she's about creating atmospheres to create emotions in the viewers. I think the rice bowl sort of takes her signature colours and sort of techno look and actually sort of reinterprets it in a very clever way in that we're going back now to sort of oil paint, but on a huge scale. So April likes playing with scale. She blows photographs up to huge sizes, prints them out with massive inkjet printers. She looks at how the technology of the printer and the technology of the digital medium that she's using to capture images sort of interact with each other and then create something else, oftentimes that looks like a sort of a hand-drawn pastel. So it's interesting that it was sort of out of her control that this became an oil painting. It was another accident in a way.
And lastly, do you think this succeeds as a piece of public art?
It's a very engaging. It's on a huge scale. It's in a new plaza. It relates to the community around that area, the Rice Bowl. I think there are many hooks. Also, it's just magical, colourful. You know, no child's going to be able to walk past and ignore that. And sort of, you know, if your children are looking at it and enjoying it, then sort of so are the parents.
Liz Faraday, always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
Hand-holding a bowl of rice may be the size of an advertising billboard, but it has the abstraction you might find in fine art. So how's it playing to the public it was designed for? DNA associate producer Alyssa Walker stopped off at Wilshire in Vermont to find out.
Every time I pass by, I try to see what it is, but I mean, I see a cup and a finger, but I really don't know. I mean, it stands out.
Oh, it's beautiful. I can actually see it from my apartment building. I don't know, livens the whole place up. Let me see, we got a thumb here, and I think the other one is a bowl. I don't know, it's really simple things, but the colors they use and the design, I love it. It's just really bright.
Well, I was just looking at it just now. I didn't quite realize that they have this thumb here. It's striking. I find it a little disturbing, to tell you the truth. Yeah, it's just, I don't know. I mean, it certainly catches your attention, but I don't know. I'm not quite sure what it's supposed to symbolize. I mean, is this like could it be a thumb crushing you or a thumb reaching out in freedom? I'm not quite sure what it's supposed to be.
I think it's interesting because it has like different kind of colors, you know. My point of view is like for the gay people because it's like kind of the rainbow, you know, the flag for gay people and everything.
I like the mural. It's nice. It's great. I think it's like a finger. It looks very industrial and colorful.
Well, I've never seen anything like it before. It's like really strange. Like it's like some sort of bowl. Yeah.
Bowl of rice? Oh, I see. I didn't realize that was the bowl. I just saw the thumb. I like the colors. I think they're very vibrant and it kind of, yeah, so that's nice. And, you know, I'm all for this kind of thing, this, you know, this what they call smart growth and so on. You know, getting people to take, you know, live near public transportation. Sounds like a good idea, you know. I take public transportation.
You just heard from some Koreatown locals, Grant, Santos, Rose, Mike and Jasmine, commenting on the mural Hand-Holding a Bowl of Rice by April Griman for the developer Urban Partners with art consultant Mary Norris. It's at Wilshire, Vermont Station. This is DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. And coming up after this break, we'll hear about LA's cool modernism and California Romantica.
KCRW supporters include Cisco Home, the new retail showroom featuring Inside Green, a collection of fully sustainable 100% FSC-certified organic, handcrafted fine furniture. Cisco Home, located at 440 North La Brea. Other locations online at ciscohome.net.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Southern California's mid-century modern architecture and design has undergone a huge revival in the last decade. So is there more to learn about that era? Elizabeth Armstrong is curator of the show Birth of the Cool, now on at the Orange County Museum of Art.
The reason to do it now is that there's still a great deal of interest in mid-century modern architecture and design. And there are many other aspects of that culture, especially as they were expressed in Southern California, that haven't been explored and are really under-recognized. So I was also motivated by the incredible group of hard-edge painters painting at the same time with a lot of formal affinities to the architecture and design. It was clearly in the sort of collective DNA of Southern California, as well as West Coast cool jazz, which really in California flourished in the 50s, was quite different than what was going on the East Coast in terms of jazz. And it felt like time to pull all of this together and really look at the overlaps and affinities.
And quickly, if you can you tell me the characteristics of cool jazz and the characteristics of the hard edge painting of the era?
Well, of course, that's one of the hardest questions you could ask because there's many, but let's see. I would say there's a kind of rhythm, harmony, clean articulation, a kind of orchestration, if you will, a kind of horizontal direction, you know, that you see in the architecture and design. If you can visualize that in music, you know, California cool jazz slows down and it kind of extends itself. And you could say the same about hard edge abstract painting coming out of California in the period compared to that really angst ridden, angular sound of East Coast jazz and look of abstract expressionism.
And from your research, do you know that
The people who were designing the chairs were friends with the people who were playing or listening to the jazz, were living in the houses that were designed by the Eames. Was there actually at the time a real interconnection, or have you in a way post-rationalized the connection?
Well, I knew we were taking a very retrospective look back, and I was conscious of not imposing that kind of post-rationalization, as you said, but with the hindsight of 50 years, I thought it'd be really interesting to see if those formal stylistic affinities really had those kind of real relationships and interconnections. And the answer is yes and no. As a specific example, the painter Carl Benjamin, who's out in Pomona painting away, is coming into Los Angeles all the time. He's getting to know the other painters, but he doesn't know a lot of the architects and jazz musicians. However, he's listening to jazz all the time. He told me that he wore out the grooves in his Birth of the Cool album in the 50s. And as an example of a specific relationship, he commissioned a modernist house for himself, invited Julia Shulman to come out and photograph it. So there are these very real connections too. Again, it's not what the show's about, but they were absolutely there.
And let's get to this word cool, which is built into your title. It permeates the entire show. Can you define what you mean by cool?
Well, what I like about the word cool is that it is a term used formally in art history to describe music, to describe architecture. It's a kind of rational, purist form, but it's also a vernacular term. It comes out of jazz. And it became a very popular term in the 50s. And I love the play between the vernacular and the formal, the art historical, if you will. And that's what I think makes a lot of the works in the show so dynamic.
Birth of the Cool is on show through January 6th. It'll be open all this week except Thanksgiving Day. At the show, you'll find gems like Bill Claxton's photos of legendary jazzmen, graphics by Alvin Lustig and Saul Bass, shots of now classic houses by famed photographer Julius Shulman. Much of the furniture in the show was loaned by Michael Boyd. He's a collector, restorer and dealer in modernist houses and furniture, and currently lives with his family in the Strick House in Santa Monica, designed in 1964 by Oscar Niemeyer. The house is brimming with modern classic furniture by Arne Jacobsen, John Prouvet, Gerrit Rietveld, as well as Niemeyer himself. I asked Michael what got him so hooked.
Well, I think one of the things that really drew people to this kind of material in the first place is exactly the same thing that's drawing people to it now, which is that it was progressive. Southern California was a center for this kind of work. And of course, now we've come to the point where the houses have all been seen as works of art, essentially, that need to be saved. And I think people are finding out that they're an absolute dream to interact with. You know, they're not meant to be, just museums. They're, you know, it's not a philosophy of life that these architects and designers were putting forth. It was a philosophy of living.
And you really live this stuff. You live in a house that was designed by the great Brazilian architect, now 100 this year, who sadly never got to see his own design as it was built, given that he had never actually set foot in this country because he was a communist. But this is Oscar Niemeyer, house in Santa Monica that you bought and restored. It was due for demolition. And you filled it with pieces of your collection, 20th century modernism, right back to Rietveld. So you're living in what to some would be feel like a museum. How does it feel to live with all this material? Does it feel progressive as it was intended, or does it feel like you've stepped into the past?
I think some of both. I mean, the thing that's funny about museums is that, you know, my wife Gabrielle and I have always laughed because, in fact, we love museums probably more than anything. So when someone says, oh, your house is like a museum, which actually no one ever says because we sort of keep it warm and user-friendly. But, you know, that wouldn't be very disappointing either because we love museums. If you want to drop me into the Temple of Dendur at the Met or drop me off with Barnett Newman's broken obelisk at MoMA and say you'll come back for me in the morning, I would be thrilled. So that doesn't hold the same sort of negative connotation that it does for most people. But in fact, we do try to live with the pieces. And I think one of the things about it really is that objects, one of the reasons I think we're able to sell things and let go of things, because typically collectors, you know, hoard and don't want to let go, is that we're really interested in the ideas behind them. And that so every chair we're looking at, there's an idea, there's a place, there's a new technology, there's all kinds of things that are sort of figuratively hovering over the actual physical object. That's the stuff that we're interested in the most. So I think to answer your question, it's having a foot in both worlds that we really like. It works as a family house, and at the same time, you can be walking through the house and just stumble upon something and be reminded of how radical and progressive it was in 1918 to propose that this would be a chair. Of course, we found out later that, you know, Rietveld himself put pillows in some of the chairs. I wish we had known that a little earlier, but...
You mean before you got bruises sitting on this sharp angles?
I have a few friends that, you know, will sit down and say, ouch! You know, so that's probably not a good sign for a chair, but that's when I have to tell them that it's just an idea. It's a concept.
Michael Boyd, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And now, our favorite building segment. For some, modernism, with its light-filled open plans and inside-outside living, is quintessentially Southern Californian. But it's never been the domestic style of choice for most Angelenos. Far more popular is ersatz Spanish style, which has its roots in the Spanish colonial revival homes built after the First World War by architects like George Washington Smith, Wallace Neff, and Paul Williams. California Romantica is a new book illustrating 20 of these classic homes in the Southland. It's the creation of Diane Keaton, the actor, director, photographer, and architectural preservationist. It was co-written by the historian and writer DJ Waldy and was designed by top graphic designer in LA, Lorraine Wild. Diane Keaton says she first fell in love with the style on a childhood trip to San Juan Capistrano Mission.
You know, I was a California kid, and my parents and my family and my siblings, we took a lot of trips throughout California. We were campers primarily, and I do remember specifically this time when we went to San Juan Capistrano, and suddenly I found myself in this enchanted world, and it was almost a religious experience to just stand there and to see this colonnade of arches and to watch the light passing through, and it was an inspiration to me, and it was also being outdoors, the feel, like today. Today is one of those beautiful California days where there's just nothing like it in the world, the light, the feeling of the air, and it was magical, and I remembered it, and it stayed with me. And that's why I'm sure that, you know, as I got older, I did become a preservationist.
DJ, in the book, you talked about how these houses were on the one hand trying to evoke a kind of mythological past, but they also very much had a calculated modernity.
Indeed they do, in part because they wrestled with a compelling question. In the early part of the 20th century, what kind of house would be appropriate to build in Southern California? What kind of home should we live in? They had a nostalgic component, a looking backward component, but they were extraordinarily forward-looking in their desire to create the right houses for a place that didn't have yet its own architecture. They thought they were inventing a brand new architecture for a brand new place in Southern California, not merely re-inhabiting an antique or nostalgic or past architecture. And that's in their abstraction, in their use of materials, in their simplicity, in their desire to blend outside and inside, in their remarkable use of shadow as a way of animating what might otherwise be rather prosaic, plain surfaces. All of these are very modern and very new. They may look like medieval Spain, but they're working with 20th century issues and 20th century materials to deliver a new experience.
So, Diane, let's talk now about the photography in California Romantica.
the choice of images and the layout of the images in this book is quite distinct from some other coffee table books. I mean, for example, there'll be four to six images all dealing with the shadows cast through
With the shadows or with simply a fountain. It's like you're looking at a fountain from one angle, another angle, through, you know, a doorway, on and on. But this was really Lorraine Wild's contribution, was to keep seeing something from a different point of view. And I thought that that was just remarkable, what she did, how she would put it together. And from hundreds and hundreds of photographs of one house, it was like she would find it.
And you've also referred, both of you, to the role of light. And in your introduction, Diane, you talked about the extreme contrasts.
You know, I'm a big devotee of all the books of this genre, all the coffee table books. But I always want, when I look at a photograph, to see the role that light plays in the photograph. And I can't stand flat light. I just cannot bear it. So I thought, when I thought about this book, I wanted to shoot it with shadow and light, because that's the magic.
But this book is more than just an evocative coffee table book, Diane. It's a kind of call to arms.
Well,
to...
more than a third of these houses were for sale. So I worry. I mean, really, that was my ultimate goal, to somehow, you know, help preserve these homes.
And why do you think these houses are for sale? Because people don't want to live in them, or because they've become so sought after that people want to get a good sale?
Well, you know, we are experiencing right now a kind of a downturn. But regarding these specifically, I think they're afraid of them. They're afraid of the work. And, you know, it does take a little work to maintain them. But it's something. Have them call me, okay? I'll do the work for them. I really mean it. I mean, they're fabulous. They adjust to modern life completely.
So these houses really still are at risk, even the ones by these top names.
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely.
These houses are from a different era with a different way of life. They are in transition from the 19th century into the 20th century. Contemporary owners may be startled by their apparent formality, because they were made for a period when many homes had servants and the interior spaces of houses were arranged differently than homes are today. But everything else about these houses is of the moment today. The way in which they are on the land, respecting the landscape, the way in which they bring outside inside, the way in which they make use of outdoor spaces if it was another room of your house.
Very important what DJ just said, and I completely agree with that. But I also have to say, and I also have to add, they're very diverse. And they're all completely uniquely individual.
Yeah, and what challenges a new owner today is to see how this house lives in the present, but also borrow some of the sweetness of life that was there when the house was first built 80, 90 years ago.
Diane Keaton and DJ Waldie, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can hear Diane Keaton and DJ Waldie discuss California Romantica next Tuesday evening at Book Soup and next Wednesday evening at the Huntington Library. More details on our website. Also worth visiting if you've time this holiday period is a show of work of cutting-edge architecture from my old country. Gritty Brits, New London Architecture, is on show at the University Art Museum in Santa Barbara through January 20. That's it for this month's DNA. Thanks very much for listening. The show was produced by Ray Guana with production assistance from Melissa Walker. The consulting producer is Jennifer Ferrow. Thanks to Nan Sherry Lieberman for managing the website. You can listen to today's or past shows anytime by going to kcrw.com/DNA. You can also podcast the show from there or iTunes. I'm Frances Anderton. Have a very happy Thanksgiving and join me next month for DNA's December holiday show.